Hello, on this week's program we take a walk through Adventures in Modern Art, the Charles K. Williams II Collection, a new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and speak with the show's organizer, Innes Shoemaker. David Patrick Stearns looks ahead to a vocal recital in Ocean City by husband and wife opera stars Eileen Perez and Stephen Costello. Susan Lewis looks at a new exhibition exploring the ways American architects are using recycled materials to address social issues. And Jason Pfeiffer explores the role and history of the Pennsylvania Guild of Craftsmen, a 65-year-old organization dedicated to preserving and promoting fine crafts. That's all I had this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
A new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art explores the collection of one of Philadelphia's most avid and successful contemporary collectors of modern art. Charles K. Williams II is an esteemed archaeologist who has also, over the past 20 years, amassed a collection of 20th century paintings, drawings, and sculptures that is breathtaking in its scale and range. Artists whose works adorn great public collections also crowd the walls of Williams's Philadelphia apartment. Household names like Joseph Stella, Charles Demuth, Giorgio de Chirico, Grant Wood, George O'Keefe, John Singer Sargent, Thomas Hart Benton, and more. More than 100 works from this collection are featured in Adventures in Modern Art, the Charles K. Williams II Collection, now at the Darnes Galleries of the Philadelphia Museum of Art. The museum's senior curator of prints, drawings, and photographs, Innes Shoemaker, organized the show. Take us back to the first time you walked into his apartment. And it is an apartment that this is usually hung in, on very crowded walls.
Well, of course, when I first met him, it wasn't as crowded as it is now. But when you do walk in now, you just see not only paintings that are double hung or in a kind of blaze of color, but he installs it in a way, he reinstalls it all the time, he changes it all the time. And so I find that every time I go there, it's different.
Did the way he approaches hanging his own works at home have any impact on how you approached hanging the show?
In general, no, although the room where the Thomas Hart Benton contains many works that he has hanging in his dining room. But he has a long corridor that's full of pictures. They're all over the place.
What are the special challenges of curating from a private collection as distinct from, say, the museum's collection?
Well, I would say that it's not so much the organization of the exhibition as it is the installation of it, because I've been familiar with this collection in a domestic setting. And suddenly I have a bunch of galleries and I have an audience of the public who I want to make sense of it for. And so that was probably the biggest challenge. And in fact, I decided from the get-go that I was going to have an open installation that had no beginning or end. In other words, you can start in any room you want. But I discovered as I was installing it that I was installing it some things in a stylistic way and other things in a thematic way. For example, putting landscapes or still lifes or a wall of music or that kind of thing.
Because, of course, Charles Williams hasn't collected in the same way that you would collect for a museum, but he has an incredible eye.
Yeah, but I would say, you know, this is a museum-quality collection, and that's why we're so thrilled that he is going to and has been giving it to the museum over a number of years. But this has been a collection that has been selected one by one by one.
Talk to us about some of the highlights, to your eye, of the pieces that are in this exhibition.
Well, one of Charles Williams's favorite artists, and also one of my favorite artists, is Joseph Stella. And when you come into the exhibition, there's a splendid picture called Palm Tree and Bird. Stella paints with a huge amount of variety. There's a silver point portrait drawing. There are watercolors of plants. There's a painting of fish. There's a little abstract painting. So Stella is a big favorite. Charles Demuth is another. There are also two really splendid, very strong portraits, one by Giorgio de Chirico as well as an early and very atypical portrait by Philip Guston.
And then as you walk through the show, you come across one of the, I mean, very surprising to see it in a private collection, the Benton Apple of Discord, a really iconic painting from the late 1940s.
Absolutely. And what was fun working on this picture was discovering how Benton put two subjects together, one from the Bible, Adam and Eve, and one from classical mythology of the Judgment of Paris, and was able to merge those two subjects into a painting where you can't really separate those two subjects.
In the process of him gathering this collection together, you've clearly known him for quite a long time. Does he ever come to you and ask for advice?
Well, that's what's been fun with all of this. In no way have I advised him, but he does call me up and say, hey, I'm looking at this, and we talk about it, and it's been fun because I've seen things that he decided not to buy just as much as I've seen things that he ended up acquiring.
And have you ever talked to him about his collecting philosophy? Is there one? Is there, or is it just, I like it, I want it?
No, he's very thoughtful about how this collection is forming. And in fact, he's written a nice little statement in the catalog. But one of the things that he does is he's a collector who, he's also a scholar. He, as the collection has grown, he begins to wonder whether he ought to find things that make some sort of different statement from what he has been doing, because he doesn't want his collection to get a look. And yet, when he sees something that he likes, he goes for it, whether or not, as he said, it fits tidily into his collection.
How common, to your knowledge, are great private collections like these that are as dynamic and that are still ongoing, because clearly Charles Williams is still collecting?
They're still out there. I know of several around and about, and so it's not a completely lost art, if you want to call it that.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art senior curator of prints, drawings, and photographs, Ines Shoemaker. She organized Adventures in Modern Art, the Charles K. Williams II Collection, an exhibition which runs through September 13th at the museum's Dorrance Galleries.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Instead of children just yet, the recently married Philadelphia couple Eileen Perez and Stephen Costello possess something equally consuming in different ways. World-class operatic voices that take them all over America and Europe, where large audiences want to hear them. When they hit their first wedding anniversary this September, they'll have traveled from Salzburg to Santiago, Chile, separately, together, with and without their dog. Good thing they have a vocal recital in Ocean City tomorrow evening to bring all three of them together, dog included. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns spoke with Perez and Costello earlier this week at their home.
It's one of those marriages that might be better to dream about than to be in. Eileen Perez and Stephen Costello met as students at the Academy of Vocal Arts, bonded over salsa dancing, turned down attractive career opportunities in order to be together, but now find their lives are full of things they can't refuse. After they sang Puccini's Gianoschicchi with the Opera Company of Philadelphia in May, operas in Montreal, Italy, and San Francisco kept them separated for roughly 2 months. Costello flew for nearly 24 hours from Europe to San Francisco to be with her. When they are together and singing, a different kind of navigation is necessary.
We have particulars about a routine we get into. There's a routine for even socializing we get into. We always have to pay close attention and say, look, I know you have a show. Is this something you'd like to do? No? Okay, that's fine. Don't worry. I'm not annoyed. You know?
The main paradox of such a relationship is having such strong opinions about what they do. They know each other's voices better than most anybody, but discuss it only in the most tactful ways. One of the most durable operatic couples, soprano Evelyn Lear and the late bass Thomas Stewart, regularly critiqued each other privately, though always with the preface, you were fantastic tonight. Perez and Costello won't even have that kind of discussion in their dressing rooms, much less in their living room.
You know, you might think, God, if only the guy could say it this way or that way, or, you know.
There's so much pressure on a singer when they're on stage. It's better to just practice in the privacy of your home and not be critiqued. So that's, you know, if she's practicing, I'm not going to come in and say, Eileen, you should think, it's not my business, it's not my job.
Oh.
There are exceptions, like that cadenza that refused to come together in Detroit.
For some reason, we weren't together. We couldn't figure it out, and we just realized you have to have actually like a conductor or another coach there, and just an outside opinion, because you know people you can be stubborn. It's like I think I'm doing it correctly, she thinks she's doing it correctly, but one of us has to be wrong. Obviously, it's not working. But if you take it home, you just
and then
sit
we
there
find
all
out
night
I'm always
annoyed.
Right. It's great.
No. I was right, actually, in this instance.
I know. Come on, calm down.
Their union was not the kind of career merger that happened when already established Roberto Alagna and Angela Gheorghiu formed what many have described as an unholy union of two temperamental stars. Perez, who is from Chicago, and Costello, from Northeast Philadelphia, met in such a slow, unassuming way, both could say that they knew each other when, at AVA. This is how Perez remembers their first meeting.
When he walked in, and I was at the front desk doing work study, and he looked so familiar, but like a TV star familiar. So I said, "Are you an actor?" He said, No. And I could barely understand what he was saying, because he speaks really.
Not to mention, I was nervous. I was going in.
I didn't realize. Anyway, so I thought, oh gosh, he's so mean, and I'm so sorry you offended him. And so then he is accepted into AVA, and I never thought of Stephen that way romantically, even though we were playing romantic leads.
A few years passed before they had their first date.
And it was the first time we really saw each other, like, alone, no one else around, we're going to go out, moonlight. It was a great night. And he, like, this was the first time it was the first time I really saw him that way. And then we went dancing, and he did not know how to salsa, but we had the best time. I mean, he can dance.
But I think the salsa dancing took a lot of guts, because everyone in there could clearly salsa dance. I mean, it wasn't like one of those, you know, tourist attraction salsa clubs. It was like one of those, you know, if you know what you're doing, you should be here. If not, get out. Because people were looking at me like, why are you here? What are you doing? You're taking up space.
And when he speaks, and when he talks to me, music, mystery.
Now, both are just a few years out of AVA. Perez is 29, Costello 27. But already, she's toured with Andrea Bocelli in his private jet, no less, to far-flung dates in Russia and oil-rich Arab countries. Costello made his Metropolitan Opera debut in Lucia di Lammermoor. They both sang at the Salzburg Festival last summer, he in Otello under Riccardo Muti, she in Romeo and Juliet under Yannick Nezet-Séguin. Back home, though, the Ocean City Pops is a standby. Music director William Scheibel was Costello's trumpet teacher at Washington High School in Philadelphia and plucked Costello out of the chorus for some show tunes. Costello has been there nearly every summer for a decade. Perez is also a frequent visitor, having sung Carmina Burana there last Sunday.
You know, we like to come back when we can. It just gets harder and harder and harder. Because the more and more we do, the more and more you want your summers off and just kind of relax and take a break. But to come down and do a concert every now and then, it's fun. It's, you know, we go kayaking after the concert in the ocean. It's a lot of fun.
Laugh at me flipping over. Mm-hmm.
Not all audiences have been as lucky as Philadelphians to hear this couple so frequently. That's one explanation why amateur videos of their live performances turn up so often on YouTube. They also appear on lists of operatic bootleg recordings. Some singers resent that and talk lawsuits. Not these two.
Awesome.
Great.
I hope they sell.
It would be good if they could make some real recordings, and not a repertoire that they're told to do, but music that they love to their very depths. For Perez, Puccini's O Mio Bambino Caro, the aria that inspired her to sing opera way back when, plus some French and Spanish song repertoire. From Costello, well, he's a creature of so many possibilities. I'll take that Donizetti disc he's recording in London this fall. And later, would some show tunes be out of bounds?
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Aline Perez and Stephen Costello perform in a vocal recital presented by the Ocean City Pops at the Ocean City Music Pier tomorrow evening at 8. Enduring works of architecture can be cultural monuments, from the Great Pyramids of Egypt to the Taj Mahal, from majestic Gothic cathedrals to sleek urban skyscrapers. But as civilization has evolved, so has the field of architecture and its purposes. A new exhibition in Philadelphia is demonstrating how American architects are reusing materials and space to address social needs. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers these changing ideas about architectural possibilities in Into the Open.
Around Philadelphia's Independence Mall are many examples of the evolution of American architecture, from modest 18th century Georgian houses to contemporary structures that house the Visitor Center and the National Constitution Center. But also, this month, visitors can walk up to, around, and even through a different kind of architecture. A life-size photograph of a tall fence stretching nearly 90 feet across in front of the Constitution Center. It represents the fence that in reality runs along the Mexican-U.S. border at Tijuana.
It's very engaging from an aesthetic standpoint. It also just highlights exactly what we foster here at the Constitution Center.
Linda Johnson is president and CEO of the Constitution Center, now co-hosting Into the Open, featuring the work of 16 architectural groups, displays of which are divided between the Constitution Center and the Slott Foundation, an organization that fosters artistic collaboration. Johnson says the show taps into the idea of citizenship and responsibility for making the community better, in this case, through architecture.
It's not necessarily architecture in the traditional sense of, you know, building buildings, but rather how buildings can have an impact on the community and how spaces can act in a way to coalesce communities.
The theory is that some social problems can be solved with a creative use of space, and some architects are doing just that. This observation led to the creation of this exhibition, which was chosen to represent the U.S. at last year's Venice Architectural Biennale. U.S. State Department's Cultural Programs Division Chief, Columbia Barras, acknowledges that this is an unusual show.
But that is what made it such an excellent showcase for us at the 11th Architecture Biennale in Venice, because it really provided a lot of insight into our society.
Insight into the way our society is approaching problems that are common throughout the world. Poverty, crime, environmental issues, and diminishing resources. Project co-curator William Menking, executive editor of The Architect's Newspaper, says these solutions are developing from the ground up.
In a dialogue with the architect and those who are going to be served by the buildings or the plans or whatever it is that the project is creating.
The 16 exhibits include a vegetable and herb garden, as well as images and models documenting a range of structures and designs. $20,000 houses were built for a rural community in Alabama. A swimming pool was refashioned from an abandoned barge that architect Jonathan Kirschenfeld found in New Orleans.
And he turned this thing into a big bathtub, a huge swimming pool that had to be pulled up on a tug, it has no motor, from New Orleans. And then it's floated around the New York City waterfront for the summertime for kids to swim in.
Another example of how existing space and materials can be redefined is a temporary band shell created in a San Francisco park. Exhibition co-curator Aaron Levy is executive director and senior curator at the Slott Foundation.
They took 65 car hoods, they took over 1,000 plastic bottles, they took some computer parts, and they built a theatrical space for the public. And for the short time that it was on display, they redefined how that public space was used, how that public park could be used.
The exhibition itself has been repurposed to fit a new audience. Levy says at the Biennale,
we were highlighting in Venice, 16 sites of conflict, 16 sites of socioeconomic disparity, environmental difficulty, and then highlighting how architects are mitigating the severity of those situations. And here we're trying to do something a little bit different. In Philadelphia, we're trying to address, in a certain sense, the future of the city.
Levy says that since 1950, Philadelphia has lost nearly 500,000 residents, leaving multiple abandoned buildings and empty lots. The models in this show, he says, could offer ideas to mitigate some of these social ills. No one project attempts to define what architecture is or should be, he says, but together they illustrate a variety of possibilities.
And we're trying to go beyond buildings, so to speak, and define a building not just as a physical infrastructure, but also as a social relationship with a community.
Some displays visually depict social relationships like Damon Rich's The Subsidized Landscape, an interactive model with miniature housing and government buildings connected by strings of lights to show how housing is financed by various government agencies. Rich, the founder of the Center for Urban Pedagogy, says architecture is too often viewed as a luxury for the rich.
But what I was really happy about this show is I think it takes really seriously the notion that design can be more than just a niche consumer good, and that design can really offer a whole set of tools for starting discussions around how we allocate our resources as a society.
And starting discussions is what this exhibition aims to do, beginning perhaps with The Fence on the Mall, which National Constitution Center President Linda Johnson hopes will prod the curious and prompt dialogue.
It is really about civic engagement, about what it means to be a citizen and take responsibility for making your community a better place.
Civic engagement has been a vital part of this nation since its founding, and William Menking says this kind of thinking about architecture is not as new as it may seem.
We didn't think of this as an historical exhibit when we began. We thought of it as a kind of contemporary issue. But then in thinking about it and trying to explain in different venues, we realized it's part of a longer dialogue, I would say, that probably started at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, when architecture began to engage with planning issues, for example, in the cities.
But still, floating pools, band shells from car hoods, and sustainable gardens. It's not your father's architecture, or even your great-great-grandfather's architecture, but it is emblematic of the American will, taking architectural skills and a pioneering spirit to conquer the wilderness of the 21st century urban landscape.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Into the Open is at the National Constitution Center on Independence Mall and the Slott Foundation in West Philadelphia through September 7th. Guilds in one form or another have been around for centuries, from merchant and craft guilds in the Middle Ages to the Screen Actors Guild and Newspaper Guild of today. One of the oldest and largest craft guilds in the United States is the Pennsylvania Guild of Craftsmen, an organization with 17 chapters and members from 29 different states. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, while the guild arose out of necessity, it is today an effective advocate for fine crafts.
The origins of the Pennsylvania Guild of Craftsmen can be traced back to the early 1940s, when the war effort demanded heavy use of the labor forces, natural resources, and industrial facilities of the country. The Pennsylvania Guild's executive director, Sherry Boyer, says First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt actively encouraged people to produce their own goods.
There was a nationwide call to citizens to be more self-sufficient.
Boyer says Roosevelt called on master craftspeople around the country to educate the general population on how to make their own clothes and other household items, like baskets, pottery, and furniture. So craftspeople banded together to provide instruction.
Some of the very first workshops that we offered were to teach women along the main line in Philadelphia how to comb certain breeds of dogs for their hair that they could then weave into yarn that they could then sew to make coats so that the wool could go to the armed forces.
Building on the momentum and unity of the war years, the Pennsylvania Craftsman Guild was established in 1944, dedicated to nurturing the craftsmen of the state and bringing their work to public attention. Sherry Boyer explains the guild represents the interests of a wide range of crafts: dolls, jewelry, leatherwork, wood carvings.
Craftsmanship is anything that is done with the hand, with assistance of the eye.
Another way the Guild defines craftsmanship, according to its program director, Nick Moeller, is as the manipulation of raw materials.
And that's kind of a broad explanation, but basically what it's trying to say is if you're making jewelry, if you're making a necklace, you are making all the parts of the necklace, the clasp, the pendant, everything involved. It's all the steps from start to finish.
I'm Scott Gold, and I make tableware from wood.
Seated on a stool with a block of wood at his feet during the Pennsylvania Guild's Holiday Fine Crafts Fair last fall, Gold is making a medium-sized salad bowl out of cherry wood, cutting away the center of the serving dish with a traditional tool called a bowl adze.
Every craftsman that worked with wood had an adze designed for their particular purpose.
And how did you get into this?
My wife came home from a craft show about 20 years ago. She had purchased a bowl, and I thought she spent too much money for it. And I said, I think I can do that. And I did some research and made some tools and started
Gold now sells his wooden tableware at craft fairs. The Pennsylvania Guild organizes three major fairs each year, the Holiday Fair, one in the summer, and another in early fall. These fairs grew out of an exhibition at the Art Alliance in Philadelphia in 1946, where thousands of people could look but not buy. Today, the fairs are venues for artisans to demonstrate and sell their work. For craftsmen like Mike Patterson, who makes trellises for climbing plants, decorative gardening tools, and landscape art, all out of steel, the Guild fairs are critical.
It's sort of the machine that motivates most of my production, because I don't do any other shows except for the Guild shows. If it weren't for the Guild, I wouldn't have the need to generate this kind of inventory.
Patterson has been a Guild member for 16 years and has been displaying and selling at the fairs for 14. A former welder at the National Science Foundation who made numerous trips to Antarctica. His creative work is now a full-time job, supported by customer appreciation for originality and the personal touch.
I think it's a love of something they can't buy anywhere else. It's only from the people who make it or at a gallery, perhaps, that carries their work. And it gives the customer a chance to meet the person who actually created the piece, and that adds a lot to it.
To take part in the shows, craftsmen are required to be members of the Guild and reapply annually with samples of their work. With hundreds of entries each year, Executive Director Sherry Boyer says upholding high standards for craftsmanship is another major function of the Guild.
We offer a master craftsman status kind of program. It's called juried status, and you can go through a very rigorous critique by your peers and be awarded this status program. And it's quite an honor, and a lot of people vie for that and want to have that on their resume. They want to be able to apply for exhibitions in major museums, and being able to say that they're a master craftsman with the Pennsylvania Guild is a big deal.
While granting master status and organizing fairs is what the Guild is best known for, Boyer says its mission remains rooted in education.
That's the heart of who we are. We provide a lot of mentorships for folks and a lot of apprenticeships for people who are trying to learn. We offer about 100 workshops a year, and they are all over the state.
Teaching the fine crafts to younger people has become a priority. Program Director Nick Moeller says there's now a big push to attract emerging artists and a younger audience as an investment in the future.
Because a lot of universities and art schools aren't geared towards saying that this is a livelihood, this is a profession that you could take. But it is certainly a profession that an art student who is determined to improve the quality of their work, it's something that they can go into.
65 years after its creation, the Pennsylvania Craftsman Guild has well over 1,500 members and remains committed to promoting handcrafted goods and their creators. Although people no longer rely on crafts as a matter of necessity, interest in creating and consuming original, handcrafted baskets, jewelry, leather, quilts, and other works with a personal touch endures.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Pennsylvania Guild of Craftsmen holds its Summer Fine Arts Fair next weekend at the Chase Center on the riverfront in Wilmington, Delaware. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony in C under Rossin Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.